Hour 3 of the show, Amy, Mark Scores, Chris Ranji. This is KMOX, and it is time to go to the guest line this afternoon after a number of executive orders have been signed by new President Donald Trump over the last now what has been 8 days. How it affects the military and operations that are ongoing around the world, we thought we'd bring in our expert. It is retired U.S. Army Colonel Jeff McCausland, a CBS radio and television military analyst who is with us now on KMOX. How's it going, Colonel?
Going very well, thanks. Hope you guys are doing well.
Colonel McCausland, let's start with the executive order to freeze foreign aid that would regard humanitarian programs, counterterrorism efforts, and weapons financing. A lot to ask about this. The first one is, does this include any aid to Ukraine and Israel?
Well, apparently it may include aid to Israel. The one exception I have seen is aid to Israel. Military aid to Israel will continue. In fact, the Trump administration removed a restriction the Biden administration had imposed, at least for a time, and that is to not provide Israel 2,000-pound bombs. The argument from the Pentagon being these kind of weapons in a densely urban environment, as they were confronted there in Gaza, were going to produce far too many civilian casualties.
These are two different operations that are ongoing. But why do you think it is, just generally speaking, that Republicans seem to be pretty on board with assisting Israel and whatever effort they need, but not with Ukraine, which is also facing an adversary of ours?
Yeah, it is difficult to understand in many ways, but I think the easy answer is that's the preference for President Donald Trump. And Mr. Trump has very strong control over his party in many, many ways, and therefore very strong control of the United States Senate. We saw that in the recent confirmation of Pete Hegseth, which was the narrowest confirmation, I think, in U.S. History for a cabinet member, as well as in the House. So that's his preference. That translates into what we see on Capitol Hill. That being said, of course, Israel is a longstanding ally of the United States, has been an ally since the independence of the State of Israel back in 1949. Ukraine, a lot more recent, a lot of close relations, particularly between Mr. Trump and Prime Minister Netanyahu of Israel, and less, you know, closer affiliations, perhaps, between the United States and Ukraine, a relatively new country of some 30 years or so.
Yeah, I guess looking at it, would you say that there is an argument there from Donald Trump or from those Republicans that the geopolitical repercussions of Israel falling or being overcome by its enemies is different and inherently, or at least immediately, more destabilizing than Ukraine being taken over by Russia?
Well, some might try to make that particular argument. I think that would be a difficult argument just on the terms you describe, Amy, to make, because it seems to me, frankly, the collapse of Ukraine could, in fact, threaten NATO, the longest-standing alliance the United States has been involved with, the centerpiece, really, not only of our foreign and security policy in Europe, but really, in many ways, globally. Don't forget, it was a NATO mission in Afghanistan, the first time and only time NATO has invoked Article 5 in its history to come to the aid of a member was when the alliance invoked that particular article in response to the attack on the United States on September 11, 2001. The one other difference, frankly, or almost bluntly, or some might even say cynically, is the Israelis are winning, and at best, the Ukrainians right now are in a stalemate. Some think they're losing. So as a consequence, I think there's a reluctance on some people's part to provide additional military aid to Ukraine if, in fact, they think the prospects for Israeli immediate success on the battlefield are somewhat less. Israel has enjoyed, obviously, widespread success on the battlefield in the battle with Hamas and also with Hezbollah.
There has been a focus on the diversity, equity, inclusion, programs that exist within the military and really around the federal government over the last week plus. And I want to get to those in a moment. But in terms of military operations around the world, other than what's happening in Israel, how we're assisting there, how we have been assisting in Ukraine, are there some unintended consequences that could come elsewhere from these executive orders?
Well, there certainly could. I mean, of course, it's a matter of forces and deployments, how many troops you have and how many locations do you need to deploy? Some have said the United States doesn't have too few soldiers, it has too many requirements. And obviously one of our big requirements outside of supporting those two countries is requirements in the Indo-Pacific region, where we see more and more threats by China against our principal allies in that region, that being in most particularly the Philippines, and close relations that the United States has maintained with the island of Taiwan. So that's a concern. On any given day, there's always a concern about threats by North Korea against our allies in the northeastern Pacific region, most notably, of course, the Japanese and the South Koreans. And we've seen the North Koreans launch a cruise missile and a test just in the last couple of days. So that's a concern. Also, of course, if the President of the United States determines, as it seems he may, that he needs to deploy more and more U.S. forces to the border or involve more and more U.S. forces actually in the rounding up or the incarceration, at least temporarily, the detaining of illegal immigrants, if that gets to be a huge manpower requirement, then you've got to think about where do those forces come from and what places could you perhaps reduce forces to stay within the force structure that you have. And there has been already some suggestion the president may be seeking to reduce U.S. force presence in Europe, and that may be in response to these other requirements that we have globally.
Colonel, in your experience, what is the state of our forces as far as the numbers? Are we shorthanded? And as far as our weapon systems and what we have in reserve, are those filled to what they need to be?
Well, there's always two big concerns at the moment, I think. One is recruitment. We've seen over the last several years that many of our services, most notably the Army, which is the largest of all our military services, having difficulty recruiting. In the last year, for example, the Army was able to meet its recruiting requirement. Interestingly enough, it seemed that one of the reasons they were able to do that was a significant increase in female enlistment in the United States Army. So that's always a concern. And there is a question right now, as all these different programs happen to do with diversity, equity, and inclusion go away, will that affect recruiting in positive fashion or in a negative fashion? In a positive fashion, Mr. Hegseth, Mr. Trump, I think, believe that this is discouraging particularly young white males from joining the U.S. military and people leaving the military because they become discouraged by what they see as an awful lot of this stuff going on. My candid assessment, those are relatively few in number. On the other side of that coin, about 40% of the force or more are people of color or women. And as you move away from those particular projects, requirements, or talking about DEI and things like that, does that, in fact, discourage people of color and women from joining the military? And so how does that all sort itself out in terms of recruitment is one question. The second, of course, is in terms of military equipment, hardware, and investment. And we got some serious challenges, most notably in our wartime stocks for ammunition, because of what we provided particularly to Ukraine as well as in Israel, and an acceleration in trying to build up our Navy, in particular, and expand the Navy. And that's running into a lot of problems in the defense industrial base. And that's why you saw in the testimony Hegseth provided in his confirmation hearings, he talked a good bit about accelerating production of military equipment, armaments, ammunition, et cetera, and breaking through some of the roadblocks that we have in the defense industrial base, producing things like ships, aircraft, et cetera.
Colonel Jeff McCausland is with us, and you know, you were talking about recruitment, and we don't have a draft, so we can't force people to be in the military, and we know right. that it has been difficult to recruit people. I know that you sort of touched on it already. You believe that what's happening now would ultimately hurt recruiting as opposed to helping it? Because I'm not really sure that people are not getting into the military because they think it's too woke. I feel like that's more narrative than reality. So I'm wondering how you feel about that.
Well, I happen to agree with you. I think it's much more narrative than reality. I've seen absolutely no analytical evidence that suggests that's not true. But certainly that is a theme that Mr. Hegseth and President Trump have pushed, that people are not joining the military because of their concern for wokeness, or people are leaving the military because of their concern over wokeness. I don't think that's necessarily true. There also seems to be a possibility, the president has talked about this, for example, of changing the names of military bases, which were converted from the Confederate names in the South, like Fort Benning and Fort Bragg, to Fort Moore, named after a distinguished officer who got the Medal of Honor in Vietnam, and he may change back. Is that going to encourage black young Americans to join the military? I kind of doubt it, frankly. If you limit where women can serve in the military, will that encourage more women to join? I certainly kind of doubt it. And furthermore, if you limit where women can serve in the military, you're also telling young women that they cannot expect to matriculate to the highest ranks of the U.S. military. Well, if that's the case, I think that will be a discouragement either for young women joining the military or, frankly, staying in the military for a career, which in many ways what we'd like to have happen. But, you know, this is what we're going to see happen over the next couple of years. Will, in fact, we see a large spur in enlistment because of the removal of all these DEI requirements and training, et cetera, or, in fact, will we see that in the opposite direction? And then at the end of the day, frankly, what we the biggest impact on recruiting actually is unemployment in America. And if unemployment is low historically, and I've watched this for 50 years as far as recruits going, if unemployment is low, then it's difficult to get people to join the military because there are a lot of jobs available. And that certainly, at least for the time being, seems to be the case economically.
Yeah, you mentioned military as a career. How has that changed over time? You know, in your career in the military, you did it for, you know, your whole life until you retired. Do fewer people want to get into that and make that their lives until retirement? Or do they just kind of want to get in, serve the time they have to serve, get the benefits of serving, and then get out?
It's a bit of both, quite frankly. I'll be honest with you. When I joined the military or entered the military from West Point many, many years ago, I was uncertain whether I was going to make it a career. Over time, I found I enjoyed my service. I found a lot of opportunities. I ended up staying for 30 years. So I think there's very few people on the day they enlist or they're commissioned that say, okay, I'm convinced I'm going to stay in this for a whole career. It kind of sorts itself out over time. But the military has a real problem in that our retirement system is such that an officer or senior NCO can retire after 20 years of service. Well, that can mean they're 38 to 42 years of age. And quite frankly, they've been trained and prepared, and they're kind of at the prime of their effectiveness as a leader. And no corporation would invest in the leadership of the corporation only to see them take a full retirement shortly after the time they turn 40. So what we need to do is encourage more and more people to stay in the military. That's further exacerbated by the fact that due to changes in technology, the training requirements for a person to perform in the military are a lot higher than when I joined. To be a combat infantryman, when I joined the military in the 1960s, didn't take much time to train somebody to do that. Now, with sophisticated technologies, communications, use of drones, night vision goggles, et cetera, even the basic training for a soldier to be a combat infantryman is a lot more intense, and therefore we'd like him or her, quite honestly, to stay longer than simply a short-term enlistment.
Colonel Jeff McCausland, as always, we really appreciate you joining us and appreciate your expertise. Thank you so much.
Always a pleasure.
That is U.S. Army Colonel Jeff McCausland, retired, and also CBS military analyst, joining us here on the show. We asked the question earlier, or we at least brought to you a poll that was done by Gallup about your, or our, as Americans, our happiness, our current level of satisfaction in our personal lives versus our satisfaction with the United States and how things are going. Feel free to tell us how you feel personally and tell us why. On the Odyssey app, drop us a voice message. We'd like to hear from you. Or text or call 314-436-7900. Chris and Amy on KMOX.
Tuesday has no feel. Monday has a feel. Friday has a feel. Sunday has a feel.
I feel Tuesday and Wednesday.
All right, shut up, the both of you.
Well, yesterday we talked about the worst Super Bowl party of all time. That would be Chris Ranji's, where
the upcoming one. Yes,
he is going to supply his guests with celery stalks and 5 jars of oily peanut butter.
No ranch dressing. No hummus. No other dips.
Just 5 brand new jars of oily peanut butter that you have
to stir.
It's
a good snack.
Oil on top. And then about 10 bags of celery stalks, not yet washed and chopped.
Yeah, you have to chop and wash them yourself. I said yesterday that I'd be providing RC Cola, but I have decided against that. We're just doing tap water. So
that's no
so
ice.
If you want to come
with
to my party.
No ice. just
we're not doing ice. I don't trust the ice in my freezer.
So because of a CNN headline saying that, good news, your Super Bowl party this year will cost about the same as last year unless you try to throw a healthy Super Bowl party, at which point I thought, I have never even heard of a healthy Super Bowl party. I've never heard of that concept.
Never even heard of anybody suggesting it.
No, it's never crossed my mind.
I've heard people say, if you want to take it a little easy during the Super Bowl, you know, try this snack or that snack as opposed to chicken wings. But
crock pot with yellow cheese and meat in it.
Yeah.
Like, what's the point?
Exactly.
So we asked you, our listeners, at Chris Amy KMOX on Twitter, have you ever hosted a healthy Super Bowl party? And the results are in. About 90% said, what? Obviously, no.
Just overwhelming.
Overwhelming. What? Obviously, no. 1% said, yes. And 9% said, no, but I'd consider it. Then we had a couple comments from Duke of the URL. He said...
I love real quick. I love when serious shows have to read a comment from Twitter and they have to read the screen name. It's just so funny.
So Duke of the URL,
URL says
Super Bowl Sunday is a day of gluttony rivaled only by Thanksgiving. To suggest otherwise is blasphemy. And Farver Todd says, are you talking about light beer?
No. Yeah. No beer.
Yeah.
No beer, just water.
No, I think he's
water,
saying,
celery, peanut butter.
Is that what you mean by healthy?
Yeah.
Are you talking about light
doing
beer?
No. Yeah. Nope. Sorry, but just going back to what I was talking about.
Yes.
It reminds me of this anonymous person who broke a couple of sports trades like 4 or 5 years ago.
Yeah.
I've told you about this, and it's just a random person who broke two pretty big stories. I think one of them was about Jimmy Butler or something.
Was it? Do you think it was like a legit guy in disguise, like when Mitt Romney was Pierre Delecto?
Oh yeah, he had his burner account or whatever. Yeah,
Pierre Delecto, and Mitt Romney had to admit it was him.
Who was the? By the way, who was the athlete that went as Ron Mexico? That was his.
Oh,
Ron
I don't
Mexico
know.
Was his alias.
Oh my gosh,
Michael Vick. That's what it says.
It could
Ron
be Michael Vick.
Mexico.
Anyway, so there was a guy or a person who broke a couple of really big sports news stories, and he did it, I think, on Reddit or something, a message board, and his handle was wetbutt23. So somebody named wetbutt23 broke a couple of huge...
And they were real.
They were real.
So who is he?
I don't know.
He had to have been like the player himself or a reporter, like Adam Schefter in disguise. I don't know. I think he had to be what if he was the general manager that wanted to spoil it for the guy who made the trade?
That happens.
I also think there could be.
I mean, it could conceivably happen.
That happens.
I'm not going to say it does. I don't
that
know.
That happens.
Sure.
No, that would never happen. Maybe. I also want to know how Mitt Romney, Senator Mitt Romney, the man of faith, was Pierre Delecto. Now, was that his porn name? Like Pierre was his first pet and he lived on Delecto Street?
Dude, I don't know how he got to it. We'll research it during the break.
You'll never be able to come up with an alias as good as Pierre Delecto.
Hey, when we come back on the other side, there is a parent out there who thinks we're doing youth sports all wrong and the way we're approaching it, and it is bad for kids. Jonathan Carone is the host of the Healthy Sports Parents podcast. He'll join us next on KMOX. Amy Marks Kors, Chris Ranji on KMOX. Last week, Amy and I had a conversation about rec league sports and how things used to be when I was a kid. You would play Park District.
CYC.
Yeah, baseball or soccer or whatever, and then you would play something else in a different part of the year. Now, things have become so specialized where kids are playing one sport, they're playing all year, and they're playing for teams that can cut them or not. It's not like, let's just go play the game. Let's do all of it. Somebody who wants to change the way we do things, Jonathan Carone, who is the host of the Healthy Sports Parents podcast, How to Make Youth Sports Fun and Rewarding for Your Kids. He joins us now on KMOX. Jonathan, thank you for giving us the time today. How are you?
I'm great, guys. Thanks for having me.
So there's a clip of you on Instagram that's been...
That thing has blown up.
It has. It really has. Mm-hmm. So tell us, without us just having to play it, tell us what you said in that and what you think we're doing wrong.
So essentially, I said that the death of rec league sports is going to be one of the biggest downsides of what we're doing to our kids. And the general idea is that we have too many kids being forced into competitive environments too early by their parents. And what we are learning on the sports side of it is that most kids under the age of 9 just want to have fun. And they just want to play with their friends. They want to go get a piece of pizza and some ice cream afterwards. And it's more often than not the parents who think their kids are good that are going to these specialized elite teams and basically forcing their kids into competition before the kid wants to. And the long-term drawback of that is it leads to burnout with about 70% of kids quitting their sport by the time they get to 13.
That's crazy. I saw this firsthand with my little brother, and this was years ago, and it's worse now. But he had a kid on his team who was 10 years old and burned out, quit baseball after the season because he had been on these select teams and had played 80 games over the course of a summer. And I'm like, if a 10-year-old's burning out because he was missing birthday parties, he couldn't go to the pool with his friends on the weekend because he was always in tournaments. It takes a lot to really burn out a kid who just wants to have fun.
And travel sports are not inherently bad. It's like with any poison, the toxicity's in the dose. Mm-hmm. And if a kid wants to compete, if a kid wants to get better, then we should, as parents, help facilitate that, but in healthy ways. Not 80 games in a summer, not year-round with no breaks. I mean, there are physical therapists that I've got coming on the show later in the season that are talking about, they've got kids that are coming in who, like one example they use, the kid plays hockey 49 weeks a year.
Oh, my gosh.
Dude.
As like a 12-year-old. So he already has back issues. Hockey is not bad. Yeah. Competing is not bad. Playing hockey 49 weeks of the year is bad.
Yeah, and I'll just follow up, Jonathan. We have great hospitals here in St. Louis. We've talked to a couple of doctors who said for the first time in what they can remember, right, in history, they are seeing a generation of kids, 10, 11, and 12 years old, coming in with overuse injuries.
Yes.
Overuse injuries at 12.
So I have an episode coming up in April, two episodes in April coming up. One's with a strength trainer. One is with a couple physical therapists. And they talk about that kids are what's happening is our kids are practicing their sport, whether it is in just a team practice or an individual sports training, like private training, and they're playing games. But what they're not doing is strength and agility training. So let's say a volleyball player, she's lifting her arm over her head thousands of times a week, hitting a ball, but she's not training the strength and stability of her shoulder at all. And she is not resting. So eventually, even if kids are more limber than we are, eventually those joints and those muscles are going to get too tired to be able to support themselves. So what the specialists are telling us is that kids need to cut back on their sport-specific training and actually add in some strength, resistance, and performance training so that their bodies can handle the sports that they're playing.
Jonathan Carone is with us. You can find his podcast, Healthy Sports Parents, on the website healthysportsparents.com. And the argument you were making in that the first video I saw of you, the first clip I saw of you, I believe you were making is that maybe we've overcorrected a little bit because we went through this participation trophy and the pushback against that. And, you know, a kid should learn that losing is okay. And we've sort of gone way too far in the other direction where everything now is your kid having to try out at like 7 or 8 years old, as opposed to just getting to play.
And, or being told they're not good enough at that age.
Right. And mm-hmm. so, I mean, I think it shouldn't, it should go without saying why that's a bad thing, but why do you think it is a bad thing?
The thing I go back to, let's set aside the emotional self-confidence issues that we're creating and look at just the body development of kids. The best kids at 7 and 8 are rarely ever the best kids at 17 and 18 because of a thing called puberty. Puberty is the ultimate equalizer when it comes to sports because our bodies change in different ways. So until we reach a physical level after puberty, the kid who is the most developed at 7 years old is going to be the best athlete. The team with I coach 8 and 9 year old soccer. The team that has the 5'3", 115-pound 8 year old is going to beat the team that has the 4'2", 70-pound 8 year old, just because their bodies have developed early. And so if we're telling kids at 7 and 8 years old that they're not good enough, we're not even giving them a chance to, one, learn to love the game or learn to love being active before we're telling them, hey, you're not good enough yet, but you're not going to get any opportunity to get better either. So it's leading to all sorts of self-doubt, all sorts of anxiety. There's a new study that came out that said that 1 in 4 teens are at risk for a severe anxiety issue. And that's just teens in general, not just athletes. But we are seeing a rise in anxiety in high school athletes as well. So much of it can be traced back to at 8 years old, we're telling a kid he might be cut from his team by next week if he doesn't make the play.
You know, it's so funny. I had a good friend who was 5'6", 5'6", in sixth grade. And he was the best basketball player on the team because he was the tallest guy. He never grew an inch after that. He's still 5'6".
I've been 6 foot since I was 13 years old.
Yeah, this guy's 48. He's still 5'6". So he obviously was not going to be the star basketball player in college. And that's such a good point, too, because, as you mentioned, puberty is the great equalizer. But I also feel that even after puberty, when you're a teenager, and now this is a personal conviction, and I had a friend who had this personal conviction, that they disagreed with holiday tournaments, like missing Mother's Day or missing Thanksgiving with family or missing Easter because they had holiday tournaments, and they had a lot of pressure because their kids were good athletes. They had a lot of pressure to play in these holiday tournaments, and they said, no, we don't do that as a family. And her daughter still made it to the number one college team in the country in field hockey, and because her daughter was good and she worked hard and her life wasn't made or broken by missing Thanksgiving or Mother's Day.
And can we be honest with the dirty little secret that I'm willing to bet she had some good genetics?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like, I don't mean to be rude to my kids, but they're not going to be college athletes. I know the DNA they got. They right. come from me and my wife. We are not the high athletic, high athlete, fast twitch muscles. Like, that's not us. Our kids could be good varsity athletes and they could work hard and they could learn to love their sports. But if they make it that far, great. But we are not banking on the idea that, I mean, already only 6% of high school athletes go on to play college sports. 2% of that is Division I. So if 70% of kids quit by the time they're 13 and only 2% of the kids still playing go Division I, why are we setting ourselves up with these unrealistic expectations when the kids are 7 and 8.
So, Jonathan, what advice would you give to parents? Because as you say, a lot of parents are the reason these kids are doing this, where they got to play travel ball and they're doing it from such a young age. And, you know, they don't just play park district sports, you know, learn the game, have a little bit of fun, play with your friends, that sort of thing. I don't know how you make parents not want to do all of that. But then again, there are a lot of parents who probably deep down don't want to do all of that because it's a lot of time, it's a lot of money, and maybe they just don't have the funds or energy for it, but they feel obligated to.
So the first thing I would say is to take a breath. Your kid's not going to fall behind. I know that there are coaches, and there are programs that are telling you, if you don't get in this program by the time you're seven, your kid's never going to play varsity at school. They're seven. We shouldn't be worrying about varsity sports at 7 years old. So take a breath. Your kid's not going to fall behind. And then realize, if your kid doesn't love the game, if they are not intrinsically motivated to work harder, there is no reason to force that yet. Almost every high-level athlete you ever talk to will tell you that they were the ones that pushed themselves. It was not mom and dad pushing them. So even if you want your kid to develop into a high-level athlete, that desire has to come from within. So what we have to do as parents is foster a love for activity, for competition, for hard work, and for love of the game. And that those four things can get killed if we go too competitive too early. So the advice I give all the parents, after you take a breath, let your kid lead. Give them the space and the permission to lead this journey, because it's their journey, not ours. If they're going outside and playing basketball all the time in the driveway and constantly wanting to get better, then maybe some lessons or some tougher teams might be in their future. But if you're having to force them outside to play, if you're having to convince them to go to practice instead of something else, they're not ready for higher levels of competition yet. And we're doing them a disservice if we force that on them. So let them play and learn to love it. And then we can go competitive later, because they're going to catch up.
Jonathan, I know there's not enough time for this, because I know we got to let you go as well. But have you addressed this on your podcast? And maybe we can have you on again to talk about it. But what about these select clubs, like soccer clubs and hockey clubs, at least here in St. Louis, can get super political and frustrating? I don't know if they get that way, you know, everywhere.
It's everywhere.
Okay. How do you handle that? Especially if perhaps a kid, let's say your kid does work hard and is better, but doesn't make the team because you're not the parents that the team wants on the team and so forth. It gets kind of ugly.
So a couple things. The first thing I tell people is that unhealthy adults ruin everything. and we see that across the board in pretty much every facet of life. Unhealthy adults ruin things for everyone else. But then it's having honest conversation with kids, because sports are just a segment into life. And unfortunately, there will be times in our life where we don't get something that we might deserve because someone else did something that was pretty crappy, or they were unhealthy, whether it's a job promotion, whether it's something else. So allowing kids to experience that failure and that heartbreak in a safe environment of youth sports, while it feels like the heaviest thing in the world at the time, allowing them to feel that they're under your care will protect them and allow them to learn how to deal with their emotions for when it happens and you're not there to protect them. So while you can't fix it, we can walk with them through those hard times and help them understand their emotions, understand how to process them, because that's not going to be the only time they ever experience someone making a decision that inadvertently hurts them.
Before we let you go, Jonathan, do you have any advice on how to deal with, you know, if we're talking about parents who are forcing kids to do this thing or that thing, and really they're the driving factor, there's a pretty good chance that they might be unruly at games, during games, whether it's to officials or the other team or whatever. Any advice for dealing with people like that?
From the, other people that are doing that, or how should parents handle themselves at games? Those are two different questions.
Well, you know what? How should parents handle themselves at games? How about that?
Shut up and cheer.
There you go.
Seriously. We have an episode coming out tomorrow where we talk about this concept of joysticking, and I talked about it a little bit in the last one, but parents are constantly trying to tell their kids what to do, where to go, so that they can have success in the game. What they don't realize is that causes a lot of anxiety, because when you're 8 years old and you have 50 adults yelling at you to do something, you don't know what to do. You're still trying to figure it out. We have to give our kids a chance to fail and figure it out on their own, because our goal as parents is to raise fully functioning adults who have the tools they need to be successful in life. In order to give them those tools, we have to give them a chance to develop them in safe places as a kid, and we're just using sports. So yes, they might miss a pass. They may throw it to the wrong base. They may fill in the blank here, but they have to do that on their own with their own decision-making without us telling them what to do. Sports is a really safe place to do that. So as a parent, you don't need to coach your kid during a game. You don't need to coach your kid in on the car at home. Your number one job as a parent at a game and in the car is to love your kids and to cheer them on.
Jonathan, really good stuff. In fact, we'd love to have you on again
because
there's so much more we can get to that we just didn't have time for today. So let's do it soon, okay?
I'm all for it. Thank you, guys.
Thank you. Jonathan Carone, host of the Healthy Sports Parents podcast. You can find it by going to healthysportsparents.com. Hey, there's a Blues note here.
Oh.
Yeah, Doug Armstrong today, the general manager, said that Brandon Saad is being placed on waivers today.
There you go.
How about that? It's Chris and Amy on KMOX. By the way, let's give away those tickets. What do you say, for the Golf Expo?
Yeah, be the sixth caller.
To the contest line, 314-955-1120, 314-955-1120. The St. Louis Golf Expo starts this Friday. It runs all weekend at St. Charles Convention Center. We'll give away tickets for the rest of the week as well. But caller 6, 314-955-1120. Congratulations to Frank in Troy, Illinois. Won today's pair of tickets to the St. Louis Golf Expo this weekend at the St. Charles Convention Center. If you didn't get your tickets today, you didn't win, it's cool. You have a chance tomorrow and then Thursday and then Friday. You got to be listening to this show in order to win. Got it?
Got it.
Yeah.
Can I just say, I fundamentally disagree with the concept of writing a song about Tuesday afternoon.
Why?
I just don't think you should.
Well, no one pays attention to Tuesday, so maybe it deserves love. It's a day just like every other. Things happen. You don't get to bypass it.
You could argue it's one of the worst. You're not even at the halfway point. You're tired.
Tomorrow's pretty good.
You've had 2 days of work. Tomorrow's hump day.
I like a good Wednesday.
I don't think you should write a song about Tuesday afternoon.
Remember how you've been freaking out about those drones in New Jersey?
Absolutely.
Well, President Trump issuing a statement today saying they were FAA authorized for research and various other reasons.
Oh, sundry other reasons?
Yes.
Just various and sundry reasons?
Tomorrow on the show, we are going to talk to Mayor Tashara Jones. She will be in studio with us at 11 o'clock. A number of issues to go over with her. We hope that she'll come back.
Sundry issues.
Sundry.
Yes.
Anything you missed today is on the Odyssey app. You should download it and listen to the show. We love you very much. We'll talk to you tomorrow. Amy and I will hang out with Dave Glover next on KMOX.